Time to take a look at climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, And he's with me in the studio right now. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Larry. How you doing?
Great. John Martin will be coming. He's teaching.
He teaches now. He gets out probably right about a couple of minutes from now, and he runs over here out of breath to get here before I say something really foolish.
Well, John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and both these guys teach, but there are weather guys that come by the last Monday of every month to talk about climate and weather. And certainly if you have a question, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and that address is talk@WPR.org. And certainly the weather in the Dakotas, North Dakota, has been...
Yeah, it's been another one of those years where they get a lot of precipitation, frozen grounds, streams fill up, and there's no place for the water to go. It's pretty...
pretty sad.
Pretty bad, pretty sad, yeah.
Yeah, and it seems... Is this been going on for a long time, or is it... I'm trying to think back, and it's just been the last couple of years when I've noticed it the most.
Yeah, but I think the really bad floods were, back in 93, I think it was.
Back in 98.
Yeah.
So
they haven't had it that bad, yeah. I mean, it seems like they always get flooded, probably because of the terrain is so flat.
Yeah.
That if you get a lot of precipitation in one spot, the water levels are going to rise. Particularly if you get that rain right after wintertime when the ground is frozen.
Yeah, and is the ground really still frozen pretty much here in Wisconsin?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't looked how deep down the frost line goes, but things have been warming up enough. I'd be surprised if it's that frozen.
At least in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, at least in southern. I don't know about northern. That's a good point. I haven't been up walking the grasslands of northern Wisconsin.
Well, Adam in Appleton has a question or comment, so let's go to Adam. Hi, Adam.
Hi, guys. In the winter months, I've noticed that right at sunrise, the temperature seems to drop like 5 degrees on really cold, clear mornings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And rebound like after an hour or two of the sun being up. I'm kind of curious as to what the cause of that is.
Yeah, one thing we have to think about when we think about temperatures, and this becomes particularly observable in the wintertime and in the fall as well, is that the temperature change of an object is a function of how much energy it's gaining versus how much energy it's losing. So as long as it's still losing energy, it's going to continue to cool down. So just around sunrise, as the sun peeps up above the ground there, and so now we have sunlight, we're starting to increase our energy gains by absorbing that solar energy. But our losses are still greater than the gains. And so the air near the ground tends to continue to cool down for a little bit longer before the sun gets high enough in the sky that the energy gains exceed the losses and everything starts to warm up.
Okay.
And you notice it in the fall as well. I notice as a golfer, you get out there and really early in the morning, right at dawn.
Yeah, yep.
The fog and everything else changes. And
yeah, I think the other thing that helps do that is that there's dew on the ground in the fall. And so as the sun still gets up, it tends to start to evaporate the fog, and evaporation tends to cause a cooling as well. So it further enhances it that way.
Interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Adam. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Nearly 50 million people live in that northeast urban corridor, stretching from, say, Virginia, southeast Virginia to southeast Maine. And the Northeast Snow Impact Scale is used in that region to rank winter storms. What are the categories meteorologists can use from in ranking a storm?
Yeah, it's those northeast and east coasters. You know, they're just so jealous because, you know, being a northeasterner, I know what it is. Now, what it is, you know, tornadoes have their Fujita scale, which measures how strong they are and their impact. And hurricanes have their Saffron-Simpson scale, you know, the category 0, 1, 2. But the Northeast Corridor, that population, usually doesn't get hit by tornadoes or hurricanes. But what they get hit by are snowstorms. And so to demonstrate the impact of these snowstorms, they've developed this index, NESIS. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. But what it is they look at snow events that have 10 inches or more of snowfall and how big of an area that covers. And then they weight that in some way, which I don't completely understand or remember, by the population density. They're trying to look at the societal impacts.
Okay.
So, you know, you get a big 12-inch storm in Washington, D.C. or New York City. I mean, it brings the city to a halt and it costs a lot of money. And so they came up with this index to kind of represent that. And the categories that they come up with are things like extreme is the extremist one. And I forget what the number is. They just kind of convert it to categories so the public can understand because they think the public's stupid sometimes, which I don't. But extreme, crippling, major, significant, and notable.
There you have it.
Right. There you have it. That's what they are.
Well, before we go to the phones here, and John, we'll get to you in just a second, John. I want to follow up on that because the Black Hills of South Dakota recently found itself in the middle of a spring storm's what they call sweet spot.
Oh, yeah.
So we're at 30 to 40 inches of snowfall were possible. Could you imagine 40 inches in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, right.
South Dakota, they could handle it. But what's a sweet spot in a storm, and what are the atmospheric conditions that are right for an event like that?
You know, the sweet spot really means, you know, we use it in a lot of things like sports and stuff like that. It's where all the conditions come together in the right place at the right time. And when it happens, you know, you can get dumped like that. Although I'll bet the NESIS index is pretty small, right? Because nobody lives out there, even though it doesn't have a big impact. And so in these situations, what we're looking at is a sweet spot is good moisture at low levels. So we have plenty of moisture to form clouds and precipitation and good upper level divergence. That's kind of the sweet spot of meteorology.
And they don't want it in Washington, do you?
They don't want it in Washington, right? Although I'm sure the people in the Black Hills were affected by it.
Yes.
40 inches, that's a lot of snow.
John in Madison, now we're on to you. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Just a quick question, and maybe this is a little off the subject, but I've asked even people from the UW, and nobody's given me a decent answer. The shortest day of the year in Madison, the sun rises at 7:30 and sets at 4:30. Okay, we get 9 hours. About a month later, the sun rises at 7, but sets at 5:30. So it doesn't evenly gain time in the morning and at night. I will take my answer off here if you've got it. But I just can't figure that one out.
You're going to be unsatisfied with this one, too. It's very interesting that the shortest day of the year occurs around December 21st, now when we have the winter solstice. Mm-hmm. But when we get our latest and earliest sunrise, don't occur during then, as John pointed out. And it has to do with the way the Earth orbits the sun. And it's really hard to explain without me having a tennis ball and a light bulb in order to show you how that works.
So the Earth is rotating or wobbles or what?
Yeah. So for example, this might be able, it's answering a different question, but it'll be related to understanding the complexity. If people can put this in their mind, maybe they can get the next one in their mind. If you look at the rate at which the Earth turns around its axis, you know, we usually say it's 24 hours. But it's really not 24 hours. It's a few seconds less than that. But what happens is that the Earth is rotating, let's say, counterclockwise. Okay. It's rotating counterclockwise, spinning counterclockwise. Mm-hmm. It's also going around the sun in that same direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so as it's turning around, even after it's done one complete rotation, or if it hasn't finished one complete rotation, that rotation about the sun actually adds an additional amount of rotation.
Oh,
and so instead of being 23 hours and 56 minutes or 59 minutes or something, that extra rotation around the Earth adds some, you know, gives you some extra spin. It's like two spins going on. And it's kind of the same thing that's happening with the Earth and sunrise and sunsets.
All right. Well, that makes sense. No, I can understand.
Yeah, yeah.
I can even understand that.
But I'm standing in front of here with twisting my hands around.
So there you have it, John. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Mary emailed us and wonders if you have any thoughts about the Alaskan volcano, Mount Redoubt, and its impact on our weather in perhaps in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a good question. We've been actually monitoring that a lot from satellites because satellites can see that explosion pretty well. There are three things with tornadoes that we always watch when we monitor them. One is how high is the plume going? And how is it dispersing? If it stays in the troposphere, then it may have, you know, decreased the temperatures because it'll look darker. You'll have like a cloud cover for local regions, but it won't have much impact on us. We're far enough away that it won't impact sunlight. If it gets up into the stratosphere, then it can have more long-term global type impacts on temperatures by lowering them a few tenths of a degrees, kind of like what Mount Pinatubo did. So this is mostly tropospheric. It's not as violent as Pinatubo, thankfully. The third thing that we actually track for, which is the more serious thing, is that that ash plume, if planes fly through it, it can stall out the engines.
Oh.
Yeah. And so we're really careful, and the National Weather Service, of course, is also in the FAA, are very careful in monitoring where that's going to keep planes from going in there.
Well, it really hasn't blown.
It's been going off,
pretty
regularly, but not like a Pinatubo type explosion or a Mount St. Helens explosion. This thing's been active for several years now, and they've actually knew that it was going to be going off pretty soon. The geologists knew that it would be happening. You can kind of see things bulging up.
But for now, at least, we can assume that.
Yeah, for now, it's not going to have impact on our weather or our climate. But it's still fun to track, particularly if you're flying in that direction.
Yeah, you don't want to be flying. Well, what do they do?
It somehow polishes the turbines. That's what they've noticed. And then they have to redo all the engines. But there's been planes, and again, to demonstrate the importance of tracking them on satellites in particular, we work with NOAA and the FAA in doing this, is that if it goes over the oceans, you know, then nobody could look up and see it. There's no way to really figure out where it is. So planes have been flying over the Pacific. Well, they'll fly into a plume that nobody knew went off, a volcanic plume, and both engines stalled out. The plane will drop, you know, 5,000-6,000 feet in a couple of seconds. And fortunately, pilots have always been able to restart the engines. So we've been lucky.
I would not want to be in a plane that dropped 5,000 feet in a few seconds.
It's pretty scary. It's pretty scary.
Oh, boy. Well, on that scary note,
fear not. FAA, NOAA are all very carefully tracking and predicting where it's going to go to. For those obvious reasons.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Our guest, John Martin, will be joining us in just a minute here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at climate and weather now with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin joining us, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW. Great to have them along. And certainly if you have some questions, we have an open line or two. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Or email at talk@wpr.org. And John, your 100 inches, less than 100 inches of snow prediction certainly correct.
Seems to have come in right. I think that's right. It's safe to say. I don't think we'll see 30 inches of snow from here until the end of the snow season.
Yeah, we're about 70 inches in southern Wisconsin, I think.
Yeah, that's about right. And even that's a remarkable year. I mean, if it had been any other year, following any other year, this would have been something to write home about. Because I think we've been over 70 a handful of times, including last year.
We don't. It's nothing.
It's nothing.
Now it's nothing.
It's a new era.
Well, December wasn't very much fun.
I liked it, but I know I'm in the minority.
Bob in River Falls has a question for you guys. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Well, hey, by the way, on that last point there, I think I read somewhere that the standard deviation on our snowfall is like 50 inches, so you guys did pretty good on your prediction.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I think you mean you guy, don't you?
the question I have is, I fiddling around on the internet, have looked at these maps of, they're graphical maps of ice sheets, and they have little squares all over them and little letters and colors coated on the Great Lakes and Hudson Bay, telling you or indicating what the depth of the ice is. Now, from looking at them, it looked to me like Lake Superior was almost completely frozen over this year. I don't know. I know that it's only like once in 30 years that it does, and probably less frequently now. What I'm wondering is I've got on my web browser, I have Baker Lake and Nanavut on there. And I see the temperature. It's still like 10 below zero Fahrenheit at night. And I'm wondering if those areas stay frozen longer, if that affects the spring as well as the evaporation, and if it affects the climate in general for at least the short term, if they get to keep their ice longer, particularly on those lakes as well as Lake Superior. And I'm just wondering if you guys could, maybe
comment on that.
You know, we had a speaker down here back in the fall from the Great Lakes Institute up by Superior up there. And he was talking about Lake Superior. And I think there's a big difference between what you see on the Great Lakes, the big lakes, and what you see on smaller lakes. And if I remember right, what it was that the length and the type of ice you had on the lake in the wintertime had an impact on the summertime lake conditions. But the summertime lake conditions didn't have an impact on the wintertime lake conditions, at least for the big lakes. Now, I don't think that would hold for the small. I think that would hold in general for the small lakes as well, in that if you had a lot of ice on it, once the ice went away, it probably would warm up pretty quick just because it's shallow and you have a lot of energy. And then the same thing, even if you had warm water in the summertime, it probably wouldn't impact what happens in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And the impact, on the one hand, we can imagine that, well, why wouldn't it? And it would if the conditions were always the same and non-static. But each year we have so much variability in the weather and the winds and the temperatures that having warm lakes in the summertime just isn't going to really impact the wintertime. It's going to matter what is the winter atmosphere doing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the lake is effectively out of play. It's so deep, Lake Superior, anyway, that a lot of that water hardly ever warms or cools. And so you're talking about a fraction of the huge volume of water that's in there that's actually bouncing up and down with the seasons. And so I think, Steve, I completely agree. I would guess the ecology of the lake has a variety of hands that it can play after a variety of different kinds of winters. But I don't think that there's probably too much of an impact on the weather in the subsequent winter. And the climate also, I think, is probably not so severely impacted by the lakes. And I'm talking global or continental scale climate, because as big as they are, there just isn't that much water vapor flux out of those lakes compared to what comes off the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. That just dwarfs it.
Except for regional climate.
Regional climate would be different. Climate would be different. But if it's on the continental scale and affecting how set up over the continent, probably not.
Yeah, I was just looking online. The Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab says there's been more than a 30% ice decline on the Great Lakes since the 1970s. So that's a big percentage.
That can have
some big impacts on the lakes themselves, I would assume, because of less ice.
You have more evaporation.
More evaporation.
Yeah. That's the
and
big
low,
deal.
And lower
yeah.
lake levels, which has also been probably the case since the 70s as well.
Yeah.
John and Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We're moving you up north here.
Okay.
Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of my brother, who is a commercial fisherman, as I used to be, being lost off of Montauk Point, New York.
Oh, hey, I'm from Brentwood.
There you go. Well, Jersey, what can I say? But, or was it Brentwood, New York?
Brentwood, Long Island, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
The point is, NOAA Weather Radio got it wrong. Mm. I mean, they got it wrong badly.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of my call is not to impugn NOAA, but they called 30 to 40, and my brother, pardon the expression, must have gotten hit in a sweet spot because it blew in excess of 100.
Oh, yeah, jeez.
And he, his boat and his crew were lost, unfortunately, and sadly. But so that was 25 years ago. What's the state of precarious prognostication today? How much progress have you guys made in your ability to reliably predict what's going to happen?
It's a very good question, John, and unfortunately brought up about on the anniversary of a tragic event. in those 25 years, there's truly been a revolution in the ability to make those kinds of forecasts, and also perhaps even to alert people based on just observations, because we've got a variety of satellites up in the sky now that can give us a really good idea of where the strong winds in these storms actually exist at the moment. So we don't sometimes even don't have to rely on a forecast. But in those times when we do, these forecasts have changed their character in those 25 years. It's really quite a remarkable transformation, both the testimony to the inclusion of satellite data and a huge volume of it, as well as the improvements in model formulation and perhaps most importantly, computer technology is just totally different now than it was in 1984. So all those things have worked to improve forecasts.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lot.
It's not even a fair comparison, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So there you have it, John. I'm sorry about your brother, but were he, going out today, he would know.
There'd be better information for sure.
Radar data and satellite data, you're going to beam down right now to the boats.
Yep.
Dave in Watertown, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question, I'm one of the probably dwindling number of holdouts against the accepted theory of climate change and man-made causes of climate change, and I'm watching with dismay as we're building windmills all over the place and counting on them as a solution to our energy needs. But my question is it's kind of a chicken and egg question regarding the levels of dissolved carbon dioxide in the ocean water and what your guest could maybe shed some light on if that is that the CO2 comes out of solution with minor changes in global temperature, how much does that contribute to global warming? And is it also considered as a result of man-made climate change or as a possible cause of the climate change?
All right. Who wants to start? John, you want to start?
I can give a start on that. One of the really big unsolved problems with respect to how the Earth's climate system works are the role of aerosols in the atmosphere and where the carbon goes in the ocean and how it's stored, so the so-called carbon sink in the ocean. I think I'm not an expert in oceanography. The notion that we are pretty far away from knowing whether or not our ocean is saturated with carbon dioxide or not is still an open question. There are many who suggest it's awful close. And when it gets saturated with respect to carbon dioxide, then anything that's put into the atmosphere will remain in the atmosphere. And in fact, some people, I guess, are suggesting that we've already passed that point because you can tie the burning of fossil fuels and the impact and production of carbon dioxide on that into the increased CO2 fraction in the atmosphere, almost on a one-to-one correspondence. So we may have already passed that point, but it's an unanswered question. I don't think it's particularly confusing, though, that the input of carbon dioxide by industry into the atmosphere is a major player in the changes that have occurred over the last 100 years.
Yeah.
Then you're both convinced then as meteorologists that it is global warming is valid. Then I take it.
I am. I can't speak for Steve. But.
Yeah. There's little or no doubt of that. I mean, the observations, both in terms of temperature and changes in ecosystems, all point to global warming. The physics is consistent with those observations, and the models, even with their error bars, demonstrate that the only way we could tend to simulate the observed warming is to include anthropogenic impacts on things like the carbon cycle.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Dave. And we'll take some more calls. You can join us again at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Michael in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry. I'd like to ask your guests if they can predict the first official 80-degree day in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, according to the Mitchell International Airport.
John can.
Yeah. Not today.
He was so good with the snowfall amount.
I'm just trying to think now. I think in Madison, we've already passed the calendar day on which our first record high is over 80. So it's probably also true at Milwaukee.
No, that hasn't occurred yet.
Not yet? Is it April 1st or 2nd or something like that? The first all-time 80?
I'm asking you guys. We have a contest going on here.
Oh, okay.
I guess the first official day.
Okay, and you want to win?
I want to win.
Because what's in it for me, Michael?
the satisfaction of helping me out.
All right, well, that's enough for me. You know, I'm going to say today is one of those days I haven't been able to look at the 10-day forecast. I'm not going to be able to help you in the near term, although I'm guessing that in the past there's been an 80-degree day sometime in the first week of April in Milwaukee. I don't know if I'm right about that. So that might cause you a problem in your contest. I'd say certainly by tax day there's a chance. With no snow on the ground, as the sun's climbing the sky, we're going to have a wet week. I'm going to put it off for at least a week. Let's say it's not going to happen until the 20th of April.
About the 20th of April, huh?
Yeah.
I would say find out when the full moon in late April, early May is, and then pick that date.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. There's no physical reason why. It's just that you'll have something to argue.
Well, you probably have clear skies if you can see the full moon.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Okay, we have a contest here in which the head of HR department will wash the winner's car.
Okay.
Oh.
We're charging $1 per guest with all of the money going to the March of Dimes.
I'd say April 20th.
April 20th.
Yep.
And I'd say the day of the full moon in late April.
Okay, I'll put that down as my guess.
All right.
All righty. Let us know how you do.
Yeah, call us back and let us know, Michael.
Yeah, I want to know when I get my car washed.
I'd be sorely tempted to throw $10 in there and go five. You know,
go right, yeah, right.
Couple of whole
5 days on either. 5 days on either side.
Right.
Oh man!
Just so you can get the title of winning.
Well, one thing's for sure: the day after you get your car washed, it's going to rain. That's a guarantee.
Verlin in Black River Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Verlin.
Hi. Did Lake Superior freeze over completely this year?
You know, I was trying to think about that earlier, and I think that it did freeze over.
Yeah, it did.
I'm trying to think. We look at it, satellite images all the time of that, and it looked like it probably did.
Okay,
so, yeah. But I wouldn't walk across it.
Yeah.
No, I just wanted it froze over completely.
Yeah. March 6th, we believe. Jim Packard tells me that it was frozen.
So. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we had a really cold December and January.
Yeah, we were way below normal for those 2 months. And I don't think February was any walk in the park.
Yeah.
We had another email. Somebody wondering for you if you would discuss dew point. Just discuss it. What is the dew point? And
the dew point is the temperature at which dew will form. If you hold the atmospheric pressure constant and you just cool the air. And so what's dew? Dew is that, when you put a glass out in the summer with ice cubes in it and you get that water film foam on the side, that's what dew is. And again, as we were talking about earlier, an object cools as a function of the energy gains and the energy losses that it gets. And as long as it's losing more than it's gaining, it cools down. And so generally we don't talk about the liquid on the glass as dew. Usually we're talking about that on the ground.
But there you have it. Steve in Green Bay, on to you. Hi, Steve.
Hi, guys. Just a quick note. According to the Wisconsin Nature Calendar by Dennis Prusik, record high March 29th, 82 degrees.
In what city?
It doesn't say.
Oh.
It does not say.
Okay. I don't know which one
okay.
It is.
It could be Green Bay, though, right? Or
it's probably Green Bay.
It could be Green Bay, yeah.
Okay.
We're awful balmy up here, so.
Yeah, you bet. I'm well known for that.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What's the warmest temperature? Do we have a record warm temperature for Wisconsin? Is it like 105?
I think it's 113 at Wisconsin Dells, July 1936, I think, or 112 or something like that.
Yeah, it's above 110,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
It's 114.
And that's just the temperature. That's not even the heat index. That's not even the heat index. The heat index must be.
Oh, it must have been awful. And that was the week that people were sleeping on the Capitol Square here in Madison because it was so uncomfortable. Now, the thing that's always occurred to me about that is, we haven't had a revolution in mosquitoes since 1936 to now. So if you were so uncomfortable in your house that you would go out to sleep on the Capitol Square overnight, up the hill from a lake in the middle of July, it must have been unbearable.
It must have been hot.
Yeah. It must have really been unbearable.
Yeah, because you knew what you were running into.
Harold in Duluth, Minnesota. On to you now. Hi, Harold.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I just wanted to know, what is a barometer? What is its purpose? And just take my answer off there.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, barometer is a device that measures the atmospheric pressure. And the reason why you care about, and you, in fact, you can use, there's a whole bunch of different things you use for it. It's a human hair in the barometer as well as the hygrometer.
Yeah.
It's very sensitive to pressure as well as humidity. But the barometer measures pressure. And the reason why that matters is because the air pressure, which is a weight of the column of air above you, tells you a lot about the approach, or the approach of weather systems either foul or fair, and you by watching the pressure tendency, you can tell whether or not you're going to have bad weather coming or bad weather leaving. So it's a very important thing. People have known that tendency exists for almost 400 years now, or 350 years anyway. So very important instrument.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, it was very common to find barometers in people's houses, and you would... And it would always tell you whether or not the weather was changing or not, depending on how the barometer was changing.
Yeah, especially on the coast, you know, there's so much maritime activity. That's right. I remember the same thing.
Everybody had one, and you'd go in and you'd tap it.
We had one. It was a kind of I recall, it looked like a little bell of some sort almost, and on the bottom, and there was a needle that went from fair to...
Right, yep, to changing.
To rain and all that.
Yep.
There's a variety of them. I think I've even heard of a guy who collected them. It might have been someone who called in here.
Yeah, so somebody who called in here. That's right.
Yeah, and what an admirable collection, because some of these things were really fine instruments, beautifully crafted, and they're well worth collecting.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. So that's a barometer. Well, how fast does the wind have to be blowing? Here's another question. How fast does the wind have to be blowing to have a wind warning issued?
58 miles per hour.
Is it 58?
Yeah. Although they're talking about moving it up, or I shouldn't say there's chatter about moving it up to 65, since we just moved the hail limit up from 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch, in which the National Weather Service will issue a warning. People are now saying, well, if you're going to do that, then why not move it up from 58 to 65? Because the damage is, and the frequency is, the damage is so much more, and the frequency is so much less.
Yeah, so it's more comparable to an inch hailstone frequency.
Right,
I see.
And here's another question from someone. Our next full moon is April 9th. Will we have 80-plus degrees then?
No, I would go with the first full moon in May.
That's a great question. No, and I think that's almost in the foreseeable future in real forecasting. I don't think so. No, we won't see it by then.
Yeah, and I'm going to take that recording and hope for an 80-degree forecast.
Well, now, why is the hail size criterion changing?
They changed it for two reasons, and they did it for the Midwest, Upper Midwest in particular, and that is that 3/4 inch hail doesn't do nearly as much damage as 1 inch hail will do. It's so much heavier, and it causes so much more damage. Plus, 3/4 of an inch hail, we get a lot of cities across the United States get that when it hails 40 to 60% of the time. It's that size. Mm. So it doesn't make sense that Yuan would say, well, okay, that's a severe type condition.
Yeah.
So the 1 inch hail occurs much less frequency, much less frequent than that. So they're moving it up to 1 inch.
Insurance companies had nothing to do with that. You
know? I don't know. That's
I wonder about that when you But anyway.
Well, I don't know. I got 3/4 inch hail, and it dented my van a number of years ago.
I suppose it depends. Well, do you get a lot of wind with hail?
You can. I mean, they can occur in a severe thunderstorm environment. You can get really damaging winds and hail at the same time.
Because I think if you had high winds and 3/4 inch hail...
Put it through windows.
Yeah,
some of those...
That's right.
Well, I guess inch hail is much more likely to go through a window.
Yeah.
It's like a golf ball.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so
3/4 inch will probably bounce off. It doesn't quite have the mass.
That's right.
You wouldn't want to be standing outside.
No, sir. You would not.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. Not without a hot hat.
Well, now, what about the tornado season? Somebody asked, with the change in climate and all this, are we going to have more? Will we have likely to have more tornadoes in Wisconsin?
Boy, I don't know if anybody's really had the guts to make any statement on that. And that's actually a sign of prudence, because I don't think we can. I don't think we can make that extrapolation about a global signal on to whether or not the high plains get more tornadoes in a given season. I'd be afraid if anybody did make that statement. I think they were overstepping bounds.
I'd be afraid, so I won't, particularly what John just said. But I wonder if the season might change, if the jet stream position is moving, because you need that upper level jet stream to kind of get things going.
Yeah, we might see over a period of 25 or so years, including the current time, going back maybe 15 and looking forward 10, we might find that the season does actually change by a week or 10 days or so compared to what it used to be. That could be.
Brian in La Crosse, you got a quick question for us?
Yeah, real quick. I was stationed in Alaska, and we had extreme cold weather. I was wondering how the barometer affects altimeters in aircraft, because we did have a crash in Alaska when I was stationed there.
The altimeter equation, which is what's used to actually guide pilots into landing sites, because they all have different elevations, and you're trying to figure out a local standard is really a tricky thing. So they use something called the altimeter equation. which works, I think it behaves fairly well under reasonable sea level pressure variations. It's not going to do well in the vicinity of a really deep, that is, intense hurricane. It's not going to do very well in the vicinity of extraordinarily high surface pressures, which can sometimes develop over a place like Fairbanks. I don't know if it's at Elmendorf you were at, but when you're in the middle of really deep central part of the winter, you can have sea level pressures on the order of 1,075 millibars, which way exceeds the average. And so the altimeter equation might give you some problems at those extremes. And I wonder if that's not a condition under which you had some trouble.
Could well be.
They shine up lights on the way in. They were too low.
Oh, they were too low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they underestimated the height of the airport runway.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And that sounds consistent with having the pressure just not behaving at a very high pressure with the altimeter equation.
And with that, thank you, Brian. With that, we have to close. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. You'll be back the last Monday of next month.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be 80 degrees in Milwaukee.
Let's hope so.
It already would have been.
Stay with us on the IdeasNet.